Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members
Teresa, Linda, and Annie,
are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature, or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. Hey, Gene, we've got a great guest today, don't we?
We have Bill Logan. I'm thrilled to start off with talking about the pollarding and coppicing practices you talk about in your book, Sproutlands, Tending the Endless Gift of Trees, which, by the way, is only one of 14 books that I've...
14 books?
14 books. And many of our Master Gardener volunteers have read Dirt, the ecstatic skin of the earth, and seen the documentary, which is how we heard about you. We've been getting all kinds of references from the Master Gardener, so apparently it's still wandering around everywhere. In fact, one of our other interviewees, Christopher, was telling us that he had taught a class
famous,
in like
Bill.
Texas or
yeah.
something about it. Way back at the beginning, he was on a panel or something, so it's been around.
Yeah, and it changed it. You know, we still find people who have kind of changed their lives because of it. And when we see that, we go, oh.
How'd that happen?
It was a good thing we did that.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess. Of course, it means a life of poverty, but at least interesting poverty.
Yeah, yeah. And I keep hearing from a lot of people that it scared the bejesus out of them.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
It's terrifying. And then Tim's a particular fan of oaks and Doug Tallamy.
Yeah, oaks are our favorites. And you wrote a whole book on oaks, yes?
I know, and I could, if someone would pay me, I would travel around the world and do nothing but look at oaks for the next 10 years. They're everywhere, and they're extraordinary.
That does sound good, doesn't it?
Tell us why you think oaks are extraordinary, just to go off on a
tangent. Let's start with oaks.
Yeah.
Oaks, I mean, that's the reason, one of the reasons I ended up writing the book was I was very interested in oaks and also interested in the fact that I grew up in California and we had a lot of oaks and there were oaks in my backyard and there were oaks everywhere I went walking and I loved them. And then I came east and there were a ton of oaks too, but none of them were the same oaks.
Right, right.
And so my first thought was how interesting that there are oaks both in the east and in the west, none are the same. How can this be? And then I started to look, well, where else are they? They're all the way around the temperate world. And you can, if you want to start, as I say, I think in the book, if you want to start a fight among in a convention of oak taxonomists, stand up and declare how many species there are.
Is that right?
And everyone will fight with you because some people as few as 250 and others are over 500. And because oaks are so promiscuous and so willing to change. And that's what excited me about them was they can live anywhere because they are willing to change. They are willing to be a part of whatever they find. And so they were really great at going north after the Ice Age because they said, hey, we can't move our acorns very far, but those blue jays there can. And so the blue jays actually developed a mouth that opens wider to accept more red oak acorns. So they were, well, any oak acorns, but even red oak, which is big. And so they were able to get north after the Ice Age pretty quickly. So that's what I really liked about them. And they were so generous to human beings. And that's what a lot of the book was about.
And they really are promiscuous, right? Because in the East, there's kind of a big division between red and white oaks. And like on the red oak side, they do kind of intermarry, right? I mean, they do hybridize.
Well, I teach a winter tree idea at New York Botanical Garden, have for years. And the students are always crushed that they can't quite get each oak right. And I'm going, that's okay.
Right.
It's probably somewhere in between.
Right.
Because, you know, and also this species concept is a human concept. And animals, if you have a mutation, you got a problem oftentimes. And usually you don't live or, you know, a mutated child. But with trees, it's quite the opposite. They're always trying experiments because they can't move. So they try one that's variegated, they try one that bends over, they try one that has a different kind of leaf, they try all that they can. So that constant mixing is important to them, and oaks are just past masters at that.
So you think oaks do that more than other species of trees?
Well, the evidence of how widespread they are suggests that they certainly are among the best at it. I mean, there are other trees that do as well, though so many of them have different specialties, like hemlocks are not going to turn into anything else, but they're really good at making lots of hemlocks
right.
and excluding other things. So they all have their strategies. But certainly that's one of oaks, is being able to move about, change rapidly. And red oaks are utterly useless for building ships because they leak. You know, red oak doesn't have tyloses in its vessels, but white oak group does. And it's hard to beat for making something that's going to hold water or keep water out of wood.
And you said they were so good to humans kind of through the years. Tell us about that. What do you mean by that?
It's hard to go back to the beginning, because when we go back to the beginning, we're probably looking at stuff that was cut down by beavers and then stolen by humans in the Mesolithic. But certainly from the Neolithic forward, you can see the fact that because oak has this very prominent pattern of rings and rays, you can split it with a stone axe easily. And you can also stick a rock in the end of it and whack it with a stick and get it to split out. So you can make clabbered, you know, it originally is thicker in one end than the other. And it's because it's basically the radial splitting out of a log. And oaks are not the only, by any means, tree that can do that, but they were absolutely adapted to it. And it is clear that from the Neolithic forward, from early in the Neolithic, there's examples of kind of bridges across fens that were made in England 60 some odd hundred years ago now by splitting out the planks or split out clabbered oak. And they had those tools were all stone tools.
Huh. And we continue to use them in construction too, a lot, I guess, yes.
Yeah, I have a friend who's made his fortune in white oak flooring, and he's very good at looking at different ones and figuring out different ways to stain them and make them look different ways. And so, yes, and you know, and in the meantime, they made ships, they made food, they're so important to people around the world.
Do other species of trees have mast years like oaks do? Because I always think that's kind of unique in that. You know, I've read in white oaks in my property, and like some years you see very few acorns, and some years you can barely walk the ground, right?
Yeah, no, it's true. And there are a lot of scientific theories about why that is, some of which I think have to do with all of the creatures who live together with oaks and the tree's effort to kind of regulate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to repeat those arguments because I'm not that clear on them. But there certainly are arguments that mast years exist in those, and they exist in anything. It's very probable that prior to the domestication of apples, the really concerted domestication of them, that they were also alternate bearing. And frankly, my orchard is alternate bearing. I got every other year I get the most wonderful crop of golden russet. But if I took better care of it, probably I'd get more of a crop every year. And you think that has to do with it. And one of the things I got to do in my book, Sproutlands, was talk to people who have used pre-modern ways of either burning or cutting plants. And there was a lot of both burning and cutting of oak in California among the tribal peoples. And they claim that oaks were not alternate bearing if they were managed by them. And the management that they did of oak was just astounding. I mean, you think of how we need all these pesticides and herbicides and this and that and the other thing. They would go in and burn the grass under an oak tree just before harvest. And that's when all the early acorns had fallen that had the weevils in them, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you kill all the weevils.
PM.
And then all of the leaves that had gotten various leaf diseases, all of those were fallen. You burned those. And so not only did you have a fungicide and a pesticide, but you also created a mild fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would send the children up into the trees to whack the rest of them and knock them off. And they would ask their mother, "Why the heck am I doing this, Mom?" And she would say, "Knocking wakes the tree." And they would knock it all off and harvest it. And it's said that they could harvest enough acorn in 3 weeks to last for 3 years. So the culture in California was one of the most affluent cultures in the so-called New World.
And then we showed up and told them that was a bad thing to do.
Or
forgot it all, right?
Made them stop. It's only in 2018 that it became legal again to burn in the woodlands. I'm old enough to have watched Perry Mason as a child, And I always remember Perry Mason standing up there and saying, have you ever seen this before? So I've always imagined being Perry Mason and putting Smokey the Bear on trial and holding up a whole bunch of those horrible insects that are destroying trees across America because they haven't been burned, and saying, Mr. Bear, have you ever seen these before?
And he stands up and confesses.
Right, because, you know, although I'm not saying that it's not important to prevent indiscriminate burning, certainly regular burning is a part of the, was a part of the life of most of the tribal peoples around North America. And certainly in California, it was crucial to their making this extraordinarily affluent culture that was a, would have been, I often imagine, a very good culture to live in.
Okay, now somewhere in Oak, the Frame of Civilization, a review of it said it's the biography of a tree, which I think is wonderful. But at one point you state about the time of the Battle of the Monitor and the Merrimack that the Age of Oak ended on March 8, 1862. You still stand by that?
Yeah, because I think the Age of Oak was, you know, so much was made of oak. But in particular, it allowed the European peoples, starting with the Vikings and then into the rest of Europe, to create ships of oak that could travel around the world. I love, there's a wonderful medal, British naval medal, that said, Nec meta mihi quae terminis orbis. Nothing stops me but the ends of the earth. Because where they had these ships, they could do that, and those ships were a product of oak. And the reason I said that and that was because the ironclads,
metal ships, yeah.
And the first thing that, well, I can't remember which one it was. It was the, it changed its name a couple of times. I think it was called the CSS Virginia at the time, was an ironclad that rammed a Union ship of the line made of oak and sank it. So that was the end of its kind of strategic importance. I would not say, I would say that oaks are now becoming more important, particularly in urban forestry. We're really trying now to emphasize them, and in fact, to create what the Red List calls an ex situ collections of oaks, even in New York City. We now have at least, I would say, 18 or 20 species as opposed to the two or three we used to do. Which, so they're becoming more important. Also, like every other tree, having more problems. I mean, we have oak wilt, we have bacterial leaf scorch, we have all kinds of things happening to them, but I think they will get through it.
And when you say they're becoming more important, are you talking ecologically because they support, you know, so many different caterpillar species and then those caterpillars are eaten by the birds? Is that why you say important or for some other reason?
I think so, but also because in our recognizing, one of the interesting things about human beings now is we've finally come back to realizing and recognizing that we are not alone in this world and we are not the creatures who tell everyone else what to do. What we really ought to do is start trying to invite all of these creatures back to the table. I mean, the reason we have nothing but Oriental bittersweet is that's what we invited to the table, right? But if we start putting more oaks in, if we start increasing diversity, there's a wonderful entomologist, I think he's retired now at University of Maryland, Mike Raup, and when we were all as arborists wanting to know what we should use to control pests and diseases, and he said, okay, best thing you can do is plant more diversity of species. Mm-hmm. More you plant, happier everything will be. Less pest and disease taking over. There'll be a lot, but it will be a little at a time and won't do serious damage. I think that's true. I think people are recognizing that. And oaks, because they are so diverse in themselves and so able to adapt, are kind of good teachers.
If you were advising somebody who's listening, who has a couple acres of land and, you know, they don't have a lot planted on that, is that what you would advise too? I mean, that's what I'm trying to do in my landscape, is plant a lot of different native species of a lot of different things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, and you know, even a few non-natives would be fine. Mm-hmm. And as long as they're good neighbors. I mean, what you don't want to plant is some kind of, like Oriental bittersweet, yeah, or something exactly. That's going to take over the house. But, you know, even so, I've been working with the Rockefeller Estate in Tarrytown with Kaikut, and they have, well, we've only cataloged about 895 of them, but major beautiful trees. Only about 55% now are native. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try and increase the number of natives, but not eliminate all the non-natives.
Right.
But I think diversity is so important. And also getting to know, if it's not a native in particular, even if it is, who likes it? What am I attracting by putting this in? And there are studies that do that. There's, what is it called? The Xerxes Society. Mm-hmm. has very good records now of a number of species and what likes to pollinate them, what likes to eat them, what likes to has different life stages on them. So I think that's one of the great things in our time for people in gardens is we're really looking at them. The whole garden is a living thing.
Well, and hopefully people are thinking of this not just in their own terms, but in their community so that their neighbors do it too. So that, and if the more you do that, the more diversity you're going to see of birds and butterflies and insects and all of that as well. It's not just the trees and plants, right?
Absolutely.
This interview could go on forever because Bill knows everything. But we're jumping to another topic about pollarding.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Powers and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.